This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 278, Augmented Lamps. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a Friday, Juneteenth, in wonderful North Carolina with my friend and co-host Michael Martin for another exciting episode of GamesAtWork.biz. Michael, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great, and I think this is going to be the most exciting episode we do today.
I agree.
So shall we get right to it?
Yes.
Shall we talk about sleep perchance to dream as a way to start off the show with a deep dream collaboration experience that you found that is a way of trying to understand how artificial intelligence views the world.
Yeah, right? this is really cool. And it's so funny. We were talking before the show started how I found this, and I had found it kind of serendipitously. I can't say that word.
Serendipitously.
Serendipitously. Thank you. Words.
You
this is how the brain
Words.
Works. while reading another article, and they talked about this site that had galleries of art created by AI that represent how AI is trying to think, quote unquote. Now, I think it was a little bit misleading with that. I think it's a really good example of how you can use AI and human activities together to create some really cool art, and it's really, really bizarre. They show three different methods of integrating various images using AI. One, which is deep style, which is kind of weaving two things together. Thin style, think of this as applying or transforming a picture with another picture. Think of it as texture, right? Or all the examples where you would say, here, take a picture and turn it into crayon drawing, right?
Yeah, brush strokes are a little different,
yeah,
and the weighting and all that. Yeah.
And then there's the deep dream where they literally just kind of munge the images together and let the AI figure it out. And my favorite one in the gallery looks to me like Picasso's Starry, Starry Night. But it's actually this just freaky thing of fish and ducks and other weird animals and buildings and like a Salvador Dali painting. And I love Salvador Dali paintings. So it is the most amazing picture that I think they have on their site. And it's just too cool, too freaky. What did you think of what they actually do?
Well, it reminded me, Michael, of the story that we had from the MIT Technology Review that that you had been able to submit a portrait of yourself, or a picture of yourself that was now painted in the style of a Dutch grandmaster,
yes,
or something like that. So it reminded me of that to begin with, but like the deep style where the face of the woman is superimposed with the tsunami, you know, the famous, you know, the great wave picture, to me is like super interesting of seeing how you can blend two approaches, and you're kind of doing it halfway, right?
I like the hummingbird on fire.
Yeah. I mean, each of these things is really intriguing just in the sense of how do you apply form, feature, function to something else and create a transformed experience out of it. So that was really the amazing thing to me. And that helps one to understand how artificial intelligence begins to reinterpret something,
yeah,
by superimposing one thing on another. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool.
Well, yeah. And the fractal experience on the deep, the Starry Night, you know, aspect was also pretty neat.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to spin for a moment into some games and gaming space here.
Ooh.
And there was a new article that had come out relatively recently, but we've seen this kind of thing before, about how healthcare and gaming are being used together. And the interesting headline around this one is that it's a prescription video game.
Yes.
So I hadn't heard that before.
Take 2 hours of World of Warcraft and call me in the morning.
And this is recent. Oh my gosh, this is June 15th is when this happened, right? From the FDA saying, hey, here's a digital therapeutic game. Off you go. And go take 2 hours of Warcraft and call me in the morning.
Yeah. This is really cool. And I guess because this one is for ADHD, right? But it's a very targeted range of kids, so 8 to 12 years old. And it's probably really helping them focus their minds, if you think about it, as a way of improving the mental aspects of what happens when you have ADHD. And I actually understand the age range, etc. Think about, you know, children's aspirin versus, you know, a regular adult dose of aspirin, right? It has different characteristics and behaviors on the physiology of the individual based off of age, right? And so it's kind of cool to see that with gaming and say, you know, you don't want to say, okay, you have ADHD, so here's Doom 3. Go Doom play a first person shooter with the hell spawn for 2 hours. That's probably not going to help you concentrate.
may not. But this is an opportunity to kind of gain some practice and focus, where the game serves a little bit of a reward function. It inspires the thought, though, of when does gaming change from being a game and fun to games being work, right? Are you grinding, right? You know,
go all the way back to what was our very, 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 very first podcast called? Because it wasn't even Dog Ear Nation then. It was before that. And it literally started with our discussion on grinding for work. You know, I'm going to level up to Java level 3.
All I got to do is write this code.
Six more hours of coding. Come on. This is so exciting. Oh, darn.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's cheat codes. Yes, it's called Stack Overflow.
there you go. Too funny. All right. So intriguing aspect of games and being used for therapeutics. But the new news here is the actual fact that the FDA has just this week said, yes, we're approving this. So prescribing the game. You got to wonder how many more of these are going to come and what it might also do in terms of physical devices that go along with it. Because you could imagine like a gyroscope kind of ball,
even better,
for example.
I mean, and I thought I threw this in the Slack, and I guess I didn't. But as our friend Epred or Ian Hughes has talked about, he got his new, was it Wooji vest this week?
Yes.
And, you know, that would be an appropriate therapeutic device for when playing a game, so you could feel the thud of the bullets hitting you when you're playing Doom 3.
Wait, that's not therapeutic at all.
Darn it.
That could initiate PTSD, Michael. Come on.
Well, see, I was thinking, you know, how could I get one of these $500 vests or $300 vests if only it were a therapeutic?
There's a whole approval process on this sort of thing too. So
I'd be willing to sign up for a test.
Well,
you need a clinical trial.
Gosh, yes. The mind is just going six ways at once with this right now, because there are so many if you think about therapeutics in general, right? Drugs, go through an extremely rigorous process before they are approved for use. They got to go through clinical trials. They got to go through, various stages of testing, make sure everything's safe, da 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 da. So given this, and us also given the idea of embedded hardware and software, wearables, what have you, there could be devices that exist. And then there could be software that make use of the devices, either the data that they produce or to control those devices, that now could be used in a therapeutic way before those clinical trials have gone through.
Yes, there could be.
And you can see how that could raise all kinds of new challenges, right, Michael, just in terms of fit for use, fit for purpose, and using them for unintended purposes too, or maybe not unintended, but not yet certified safe medical.
It's interesting. I'm currently reading a coworker's book, Rob Thomas, called The AI Ladder or something like that. It's an O'Reilly book, just came out, and it talks about the flood of information that's now available, which is making AI possible, right? And so,
sure.
Mm-hmm. And you know, how that's impacting healthcare, how that's impacting banking, blah, 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 right? And so, as you're describing the therapeutic effects of this game and the fact that you have all these other data elements that could impact it to turn it into a clinical trial, that just logically flows into that basic idea of the ladder and the fact that you could pull this off in such a way that you could identify if the kid is playing. Back to our ADHD example, right? Are they playing for enjoyment, or are they actually playing to get the clinical relief it's trying to achieve?
Yes, I think both of those examples are really, really intriguing, and this is opening up entirely new worlds that much faster, because in playing the game, you could do all kinds of retinal measurement and you could, check and see the engagement level and a whole range of aspects like this to then measure and do a full set of A/B testing right there to see, okay, if I tweak this component of the game, am I getting a better result or am I getting a slightly worse result? And, how do you go about doing that within the ethical confines and bounds too? Because something that is deemed to be appropriate, therapeutic, safe, et cetera, yes, you want to evolve it, but at the same time, you want to deliver the best experience and the intended benefit.
Yes.
Right. For the patient in this case. And this is opening up things in a whole new different way. Okay. I'm going to geek out on this a little bit later, but we've got all these other things that we want to talk about.
We've hit two articles out of our massive list.
Yeah,
about, and we're halfway through our time. 370.
I know. How does that happen?
It's good stuff.
Longtime listeners of the show may know that, Michael, you and I are always interested in data and privacy and a whole range of things.
Nah.
Right? At least a little bit. A little bit, right? So, I came across this article out of the Los Angeles Times over the week, looking at an example of what is happening in South Korea to register for being out in public and to provide a track and trace mechanism to allow for hopefully the unlikely circumstance that there may be a coronavirus hotspot that's happened and being able now to connect back in to various people. So in some ways, this is no different than the Apple and Google structure that's being built into the latest versions of Android and iOS. But this is a precursor.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, as listeners may know, I stopped using Foursquare 4 or 5 years ago now. And I know, people use it to kind of just track where they've been. But that same type of capability actually provides a really good history of when people are where, and if people check in when they get there, you also kind of know who is there. So this is kind of that same model in my mind, right? So, having a public registry of who's where, when, in order to improve the manual track and trace that needs to occur, because as soon as you identify that these people were at that nightclub and that one person has tested positive, you know, not only can you do the contact tracing that's necessary to help reduce the spread of COVID-19, you could also do the same thing for things such as sexually transmitted diseases or criminal behavior or many, many other things, which is why the public database or even private public database versus the kind of double secret version that Apple and Google are trying to do really says, you know, what are the things that are most important to you in the design of these activities? Is it privacy with health, or is it health and to heck with privacy? At least that's where my mind goes. And I know we won't hit it in the show notes, but we might throw it into the links on the show. The source code for the first deployment of the Google Apple COVID-19 tracing app that was used in Germany is now available on GitHub. So you can actually go through and read the code and understand the behavior and see, you know, is it truly achieving the privacy desires that are the starting point of that version of a contact tracing capability versus, you know, some of these other ones. And this one's kind of neat because, you know, you just scan in with the QR code. When you get there, it notices who you are because it's got your phone information at that point. And I assume they have to scan out. Otherwise, you assume everybody's there until they scan somewhere else, right?
Well, yeah, and that to me was the interesting thing here. So these nightclubs in South Korea are ones where the way they've structured this was that you essentially had a sign-in log, kind of like at a hotel, right? So I'm signing in for, you know, staying here for the night. And that's a little bit different than the German implementation and all the rest that are coming on the Google and iOS. Google Apple version, where that is storing in a separate database about proximity. Uh-huh. This is a place. And one of the things that to struck me about all this was the now that there are QR code enablements, you can't just sign in as John Smith was here. You're actually getting scanned. And that now provides a level of, okay, so who physically was there? And at what time?
Yep.
So you're right. You'd have to do a checkout procedure if you're going to go do that too. So this implementation, that was the part of the article that kind of struck me as an interesting switch in another vector to be thinking about. Now, on the subject of privacy and just kind of keeping on this theme, our friend Lexus, had shot us an example of another IoT structure about all the devices that are connected to the internet and how all of those might begin to impact the world in terms of privacy too. So another intriguing new aspect of this, and it begs the question about subjects such as, oh, I don't know, maybe even a lamp, as very simple as that. Is a lamp an IoT device? Well, maybe. It depends on who's listening, right? And it depends on how it's being used, right?
Well, it's actually interesting, and I like that masterfully weaving together these two stories. the concern with things like Shodan, if people remember Shodan's the online database that allows for you to identify open ports on IoT devices, right? Mm-hmm. I know that years ago there was a problem with the Telnet port was publicly facing and open on all HP printers. So you could Telnet in, there was a version of Linux running on them, you could install your software, and you've now taken a bunch of HP printers and dummied them up for whatever nefarious reasons you may want to have. Because printers nowadays don't just print, they are full-blown computers, right? And Shodan was a concern there. This article that Alexis sent us, really kind of goes through a a set of analysis and papers that are being done at ACM from last year. So the the Advanced Computing, what does the M stand for in ACM? I can't remember.
I don't remember right offhand either.
Yeah. from a set of papers written in 2019 that really kind of go through identifying and measuring privacy in IoT devices. So the Monitor Lab at Northeastern University is one example of these test beds where they're trying to figure it out. And then you go into some really, really interesting stuff that was announced this week at the online version of Black Hat, which just blows me away, right? do you trust running the website? Because they have the, try to hack people who show up at Black Hat. But they did it this year online. The team from the University at Negev has put out some research, and they've done a similar thing a while back where they're showing how you can eavesdrop on conversations. The idea of a IoT lamp is not a big deal. I mean, we've got the Philips Hue lights and all kinds of connected lights nowadays. This is not that. This is literally if you have a light bulb hanging in the middle of a room, right? And they have calculated the resonant frequency of the light bulb and the impact of voice against the resonant frequency of that light bulb in order to turn the light bulb itself into a microphone. And so from about 25 yards away, or actually 27 yards, 25 meters away, they are able to use a high resolution telescope to capture the frequency modulation of the resonant frequency of that light bulb and then cut out the noise, and what you're left with is the spoken voice in the room. So as long as you have line of sight, you can basically listen in on a room.
If there is a light bulb in it.
If there's a light bulb. Now, they've done similar things in the past with like glass, right? The glass on a window, right? Because it vibrates, and you can figure that out too. So what this is really saying is the compute power that we have now and the algorithms in calculation of differentiation between noise and non-noise within the constraints of a system has gotten so great that literally, and I do mean this literally, any hard surface that has any tendency to have a resonant frequency can be used as a microphone.
Absolutely mind-blowing, isn't it, Michael?
Isn't it? It's like this is well beyond what we thought in the science fiction world or the spy thrillers of yesterday, right? This is now, it's available, and I mean you now have to consider total blackout rooms. Go into the middle of a cement bunker in the middle of a large warehouse that's inside of another dome, and then maybe you can talk. This just blew me away.
I remember the earlier incarnations of this sort of thing too. Mm-hmm. The whole laser way to detect some of these vibrations and structures. But to me, this is a key. You can measure small differences like this, and you can go. And I think we're probably not that far away from being able to detect, other means here too, where you might be able to even model with enough compute power the way the air probably is vibrating. That's called sound, right? But still.
This says understanding the physics at such a level and having the compute power to take and model out that the entire system, it just blows my mind.
Yeah.
There's a really good discussion at the last 20 minutes of this week's Security Now with Steve Gibson over at sgrc.com. and or grc.com, sorry, it's the GibsonResearchCorp.com, and it's amazing. I it blows me away. We are well beyond science fiction. This is science fact. And I'm loving it.
Michael, as you alluded to a few minutes ago, we're like not even anywhere close to where we wanted to be today. But there's at least one more thing I want to touch on briefly before we run out of time for our conversation. And that is a Kickstarter you participated in, but has struck me as just like, okay, here's an IoT wearable device, an Oura Ring, O-U-R-A, if you need the spelling for my pronunciation. It's part of what the NBA is planning to use to get things rocking and rolling again for what the Professional Basketball Association is going to do in Walt Disney World. And this has got a mechanism to determine how close you are to other people and be able to use reporting and such to be able to show that. So they call it a proximity alarm. The thing that grabbed me for this was, first of all, the form factor, right? So a ring in so many cultures in the world is an implication of commitment. It's an implication of engagement. And I mean that, I guess, in both terms of the word. It's a bit different than some of the things that we've seen before, where you might wear a bracelet or something like that that would perform much the same function. So to me, selecting this form of a way of having a wearable that can be used for this purpose is an intriguing thing on a lot of levels. And I wonder whether it might impact either the meaning and significance of rings in general, right? Is one way to go, or if it is going to then take on some other higher level of meaning too, that, you know, a corporation, when they hire you, are providing something like this to you as part of your job. And it's now this outward signal that's not a badge that you wear around your neck, but it is a ring that you wear on your finger. So that was my intriguing part of this, Michael. I was wondering, you know, having been a backer of this before, what are your thoughts on
that?
Well,
I think for the sport that they're using it for, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, this is, it's a ring. It's and doesn't have any gems or anything on it. It's just a solid band. So it would not impact the players. It's unobtrusive. The ability to have all these sensors that are built into it is important. Matter of fact, earlier this week there was a special on ESPN that went through. So ESPN is a US-based sports network on TV that went through all the things that all the different major professional sports leagues in the US are doing to restart their seasons. So they went through the NWSL, the WNBA, the NBA, the NFL, the NHL, and Major League Baseball. And there's really two places. They're all either going to be playing in Florida at a Disney property, right? So ESPN and ABC and Disney are all owned by the same company. Or they're playing in Utah. And all of them are trying to do some level of testing, validation, separation, set up a bubble for the players and their entourage and this coach and the staff and all the people who maintain the parks, etc., for that event, set up some kind of tournament event. And it's funny because the first one to come back is the NWSL, which is the National Women's Soccer League in the U.S., and as of today, one of the players has already tested positive, and they haven't even started. So there's hope for sports. We need technology to help keep the players, and not just the players, but all the participants in the event safe. This is interesting, and like I said, it is that unobtrusive piece of equipment that can be worn in such a way that doesn't impact the play.
Yeah, I see that. At the same time, the angle of attack here is that if you're playing soccer wearing one of these rings, you still need to get within 2 meters of another player in order to get the ball.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was so funny because they were like, I think it was every sport was talking about how, you know, they're a contact sport. And I was like, Major League Baseball, really? Every other sport, I understand. You're tackling each other, whether that's
the catcher does sometimes get the ball, yeah, to prevent,
and the guy on first base tags the
home.
Guy, right? So, but I was like, you know, Major League Baseball, of all of them, you are the least contact. So, yeah, interesting. Yeah. Interesting story, and interesting use of the tech.
Well, so Michael, unfortunately, that is our time for today.
Oh, no.
So we are going to have all kinds of show notes and extra things for you to check out. Please do. And we'd love to hear what you think about them. What you think about privacy, what you think about use of data, what you think about different wearables. Maybe it would help a hockey player or a soccer player be able to do more. Love to hear that.
Yes.
Send us your links. Send us your ideas. And we'd love to bring them up for you next time on
Games at Work.
Games at Work.
Biz.
Biz. See ya.
Bye. You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and we'd like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz, or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.